Side 6. Congo. Continuing on page 259. In this rich panorama, they noticed certain missing elements. The people of Zinj had dogs used for hunting, and a variety of civet cat kept as household pets, yet it had apparently never occurred to them to use animals as beasts of burden. All manual labor was done by human slaves, and they apparently never discovered the wheel, for there were no carts or rolling vehicles. Everything was carried by hand in baskets. Monroe looked at the pictures for a long time and finally said, "Something else is missing." They were looking at a scene from the diamond mines, the dark pits in the ground from which men emerged carrying baskets heaped with gems. "Of course," Monroe said, snapping his fingers. "No police." Elliot suppressed a smile. He considered it only too predictable that a character like Monroe would wonder about police in this long-dead society. But Monroe insisted his observation was significant. "Look here," he said. "This city existed because of its diamond mines. It had no other reason for being out here in the jungle. Zinj was a mining civilization. Its wealth, its trade, its daily life, everything depended upon mining. It was a classic one-crop economy. And yet they didn't guard it, didn't regulate it, didn't control it." Elliot said, "There are other things we haven't seen. Pictures of people eating, for example. Perhaps it was taboo to show the guards." "Perhaps," Monroe said, unconvinced. "But in every other mining complex in the world, guards are ostentatiously prominent as proof of control. Go to the South African diamond mines or the Bolivian emerald mines, and the first thing you are made aware of is the security. But here," he said, pointing to the reliefs, "there are no guards." Karen Ross suggested that perhaps they didn't need guards. Perhaps the Zinjian society was orderly and peaceful. "After all, it was a long time ago," she said. "Human nature doesn't change," Monroe insisted. When they left the gallery, they came to an open courtyard overgrown with tangled vines. The courtyard had a formal quality, heightened by the pillars of a temple-like building to one side. Their attention was immediately drawn to the courtyard floor. Strewn across the ground were dozens of stone paddles of the kind Elliot had previously found. "I'll be damned," Elliot said. They picked their way through this field of paddles and entered the building they came to call the temple. It consisted of a single, large, square room. The ceiling had been broken in several places, and hazy shafts of sunlight filtered down. Directly ahead, they saw an enormous mound of vines, perhaps 10 feet high, a pyramid of vegetation. Then they recognized that it was a statue. Elliot climbed up on the statue and began stripping away the clinging foliage. It was hard work. The creepers had dug tenaciously into the stone. He glanced back at Monroe. "Better?" "Come and look," Monroe said, with an odd expression on his face. Elliot climbed down, stepped back to look. Although the statue was pitted and discolored, he could clearly see an enormous standing gorilla, the face fierce, the arms stretched wide. In each hand, the gorilla held stone paddles like cymbals, ready to swing them together. "My God," Peter Elliot said. "Gorilla," Monroe said with satisfaction. Ross said, "It's all clear now. These people worshipped gorillas. It was their religion." "But why would Amy say they weren't gorillas?" "Ask her," Monroe said, glancing at his watch. "I have to get us ready for tonight." 3. Attack. They dug a moat outside the perimeter fence with collapsible metalloid shovels. The work continued long after sundown. They were obliged to turn on the red night lights while they filled the moat with water diverted from the nearby stream. Ross considered the moat a trivial obstacle. It was only a few inches deep and a foot wide. A man could step easily across it. In reply, Monroe stood outside the moat and said, "Amy, come here. I'll tickle you." With a delighted grunt, Amy came bounding toward him, but stopped abruptly on the other side of the water. "Come on, I'll tickle you," Monroe said again, holding out his arms. "Come on, girl." Still she would not cross. She signed irritably. Monroe stepped over and lifted her across. "Gorillas hate water," he told Ross. "I've seen them refuse to cross a stream smaller than this." Amy was reaching up and scratching under his arms, then pointing to herself. The meaning was perfectly clear. Women, Monroe sighed, and bent over and tickled her vigorously. Amy rolled on the ground, grunting and snuffling and smiling broadly. When he stopped, she lay expectantly on the ground, waiting for more. That's all, Monroe said. She signed to him. Sorry, I don't understand. No, he laughed. Signing slower doesn't help. And then he understood what she wanted, and he carried her back across the moat again into the camp. She kissed him wetly on the cheek. Better watch your monkey, Monroe said to Elliot as he sat down to dinner. He continued in this light, bantering fashion, aware of the need to loosen everybody up. They were all nervous, crouching around the fire. But when the dinner was finished and Cahega was off setting out the ammunition and checking the guns, Monroe took Elliot aside and said, "Chain her in your tent. If we start shooting tonight, I'd hate to have her running around in the dark. Some of the lads may not be too particular about telling one gorilla from another. Explain to her that it may get very noisy from the guns, but she should not be frightened." "Is it going to get very noisy?" Elliot said. "I imagine," Monroe said. He took Amy into his tent and put on the sturdy chain leash she often wore in California. He tied one end to his cot, but it was a symbolic gesture. Amy could move it easily if she chose to. He made her promise to stay in the tent. She promised. He stepped to the tent entrance, and she signed, "Amy like Peter." "Peter like Amy," he said, smiling. "Everything's going to be fine." He emerged into another world. The red nightlights had been doused, but in the flickering glow of the campfire, he saw the goggle-eyed sentries in position around the compound. With the low, throbbing pulse of the electrified fence, this sight created an unearthly atmosphere. Peter Elliott suddenly sensed the precariousness of their position. A handful of frightened people deep in the Congo rainforest, more than 200 miles from the nearest human habitation. Waiting. He tripped over a black cable on the ground. Then he saw a network of cables snaking over the compound, running to the guns of each sentry. He noticed then that the guns had an unfamiliar shape. They were somehow too slender, too insubstantial, and that the black cables ran from the guns to squat, snub-nosed mechanisms mounted on short tripods at intervals around the camp. He saw Ross near the fire, setting up the tape recorder. "What the hell is all this?" he whispered, pointing to the cables. "That's a lay trap for laser-tracking projectile," she whispered. "The lay trap system consists of multiple LGSDs attached to sequential RFSDs." She told him that the sentries held guns which were actually laser-guided sight devices linked to rapid-firing sensor devices on tripods. "They lock onto the target," she said, "and do the actual shooting once the target is identified. It's a jungle warfare system. The RFSDs have Marlan baffle silencers, so the enemy won't know where the firing is coming from. Just make sure you don't step in front of one, because they automatically lock onto body heat." Ross gave him the tape recorder and went off to check the fuel cells powering the perimeter fence. Elliot glanced at the sentries in the outer darkness. Monroe waved cheerfully to him. Elliot realized that the sentries, with their grasshopper goggles and their acronymic weapons, could see him far better than he could see them. They looked like beings from another universe, dropped into the timeless jungle. Waiting. The hours passed. The jungle perimeter was silent, except for the murmur of water in the moat. Occasionally, the porters called to one another softly, making some joke in Swahili. But they never smoked, because of the heat-sensing machinery. 11 o'clock passed, and then midnight, and then 1 o'clock. He heard Amy snoring in his tent, her noisy rasping audible above the throb of the electrified fence. He glanced over at Ross, sleeping on the ground, her finger on the switch for the nightlights. He looked at his watch and yawned. Nothing was going to happen tonight. Monroe was wrong. Then he heard the breathing sound. The sentries heard it, too, swinging their guns in the darkness. Elliot pointed the recorder microphone toward the sound, but it was hard to determine its exact location. The wheezing sighs seemed to come from all parts of the jungle at once, drifting with the night fog, soft and pervasive. He watched the needles wiggle on the recording gauges, and then the needles bounced into the red. As Elliot heard a dull thud and the gurgle of water, everyone heard it. The sentries clicked off their safeties. Elliot crept with his tape recorder toward the perimeter fence and looked out at the moat. Foliage moved beyond the fence. The sighing grew louder. He heard the gurgle of water and saw a dead tree trunk lying across the moat. That was what the slapping sound had been, a bridge being placed across the moat. In that instant, Elliot realized they had vastly underestimated whatever they were up against. He signaled Monroe to come and look, but Monroe was waving him away from the fence and pointing emphatically to the squat tripod on the ground near his feet. Before Elliot could move, the colobus monkeys began to shriek in the trees overhead, and the first of the gorillas silently charged. He had a glimpse of an enormous animal, distinctly gray in color, racing up to him as he ducked down. A moment later, the gorilla hit the electrified fence with a shower of spitting sparks and the odor of burning flesh. It was the start of an eerie, silent battle. Emerald laser beams flashed through the air. The tripod-mounted machine guns made a soft thew-thew-thew as the bullets spit outward, the aiming mechanisms whining as the barrel spun and fired again. Every tenth bullet was a white phosphorus tracer. The air was crisscrossed green and white over Elliot's head. The gorillas attacked from all directions. Six of them simultaneously hit the fence and were repelled in a crackling burst of sparks. Still more charged, throwing themselves on the flimsy perimeter mesh, yet the sizzle of sparks and the shriek of the colobus monkeys was the loudest sound they heard. And then he saw gorillas in the trees overhanging the campsite. Monroe and Kahiga began firing upward, silent laser beams streaking into the foliage. He heard the sighing sound again. Elliot turned and saw more gorillas tearing at the fence, which had gone dead. There were no more sparks. And he realized that this swift, sophisticated equipment was not holding the gorillas back. They needed the noise. Monroe had the same thought because he shouted in Swahili for the men to hold their fire and called to Elliot, "Pull the silencers! The silencers!" Elliot grabbed the black barrel on the first tripod mechanism and plucked it away, swearing it was very hot. Immediately, as he stepped away from the tripod, a stuttering sound filled the air, and two gorillas fell heavily from the trees, one still alive. The gorilla charged him as he pulled away the silencer from the second tripod. The stubby barrel swung around and blasted the gorilla at very close range. Warm liquid spattered Elliot's face. He pulled the silencer from the third tripod and threw himself to the ground. Deafening machine gun fire and clouds of acrid cordite had an immediate effect on the gorillas. They backed off in disorder. There was a period of silence, although the sentries fired laser shots that sent the tripod machine scanning rapidly across the jungle landscape, whirring back and forth, searching for a target. Then the machines stopped hunting and paused. The jungle around them was still. The gorillas were gone. Day 11, Zinj, June 23rd, 1979. 1. Gorilla Elliot Ensis. The gorilla corpses lay stretched on the ground, the bodies already stiffening in the morning warmth. Elliot spent 2 hours examining the animals, both adult males, in the prime of life. The most striking feature was the uniform gray color. The two known races of gorilla, the mountain gorilla in Virunga and the lowland gorilla near the coast, both had black hair. Infants were often brown with a white tuft of hair at the rump, but their hair darkened within the first 5 years. By the age of 12, adult males had developed the silver patch along their back and rump, the sign of sexual maturity. With age, gorillas turned gray, as did people, in much the same way. Male gorillas first developed a spot of gray above each ear, and as the years passed, more body hair turned gray. Old animals in their late 20s and 30s sometimes turned entirely gray except for their arms, which remained black. But from their teeth, Elliot estimated that these males were no more than 10 years old. All their pigmentation seemed lighter, eye and skin color, as well as hair. Gorilla skin was black, and eyes were dark brown. but here the pigmentation was distinctly gray, and the eyes were light yellow-brown. As much as anything, it was the eyes that set him thinking. Next, Elliot measured the bodies. The crown heel length was 139.2 and 141.7 centimeters. Male mountain gorillas had been recorded from 147 to 205 centimeters, with an average height of 175 centimeters, 5 feet 8 inches. But these animals stood about 4 feet 6 inches tall. They were distinctly small for gorillas. He weighed them, 255 pounds and 347 pounds. Most mountain gorillas weighed between 280 and 450 pounds. Elliot recorded 30 additional skeletal measurements for later analysis by the computer back in San Francisco, because now he was convinced that he was onto something. With a knife, he dissected the head of the first animal, cutting away the gray skin to reveal the underlying muscle and bone. His interest was the sagittal crest, the bony ridge running along the center of the skull from the forehead to the back of the neck. The sagittal crest was a distinctive feature of gorilla skull architecture not found in other apes or man. It was what gave gorillas a pointy-headed look. Elliot determined that the sagittal crest was poorly developed in these males. In general, the cranial musculature resembled a chimpanzee's far more than a gorilla's. Elliot made additional measurements of the molar cusps, the jaw, the simian shelf, and the brain case. By midday, his conclusion was clear. This was at least a new race of gorilla, equal to the mountain and lowland gorilla. And it was possibly a new species of animal entirely. "Something happens to the man who discovers a new species of animal," wrote Lady Elizabeth Forstmann in 1879. "At once he forgets his family and friends, and all those who were near and dear to him. He forgets colleagues who supported his professional efforts. Most cruelly, he forgets parents and children. In short, he abandons all who knew him prior to his insensate lust for fame at the hands of the demon called science." Lady Forstmann understood, for her husband had just left her after discovering the Norwegian blue-crested grouse in 1878. "In vain," she observed, "does one ask what it matters that another bird or animal is added to the rich panoply of God's creations, which already number, by Linnaean reckoning, in the millions. There is no response to such a question, for the discoverer has joined the ranks of the immortals, at least as he imagines it, and he lies beyond the power of mere people to dissuade him from his course." Certainly Peter Elliot would have denied that his own behavior resembled that of the dissolute Scottish nobleman. Footnote: Sir Anthony Forstmann died of gambling debts and syphilis in 1880. Text continues. "Nevertheless, he found he was bored by the prospect of further exploration of Zinge. He had no interest in diamonds or Amy's dreams. He wished only to return home with a skeleton of the new ape, which would astonish colleagues around the world. He suddenly remembered he did not own a tuxedo, and he found himself preoccupied with matters of nomenclature. He imagined in future 3 species of African apes: Pan troglodytes, the chimpanzee; Gorilla gorilla, the gorilla; Gorilla elliotensis, a new species of gray gorilla." Even if the species category and name were ultimately rejected, he would have accomplished far more than most scientists studying primates could ever hope to achieve. Elliot was dazzled by his own prospects. In retrospect, no one was thinking clearly that morning. When Elliot said he wanted to transmit the recorded breathing sounds to Houston, Ross replied it was a trivial detail that could wait. Elliot did not press her. They both, later, regretted their decision. And when they heard booming explosions like distant artillery fire that morning, they paid no attention. Ross assumed it was General Muguru's men fighting the Kigani. Monroe told her that the fighting was at least 50 miles away, too far for the sound to carry, but offered no alternative explanation for the noise. And because Ross skipped the morning transmission to Houston, she was not informed of new geological changes that might have given new significance to the explosive detonations. They were seduced by the technology employed the night before, secure in their sense of indomitable power. Only Monroe remained immune. He had checked their ammunition supplies with discouraging results. "That laser system is splendid, but it uses up bullets like there's no tomorrow," Monroe said. "Last night consumed half of our total ammunition." "What can we do?" Elliot asked. "I was hoping you'd have an answer for that," Monroe said. "You examined the bodies." Elliot stated his belief that they were confronted with a new species of primate. He summarized the anatomical findings, which supported his beliefs. "That's all well and good," Monroe said, "but I'm interested in how they act, not how they look. You said it yourself. Gorillas are usually diurnal animals, and these are nocturnal. Gorillas are usually shy and avoid men, while these are aggressive and attack men fearlessly. Why?" Elliot had to admit that he didn't know. "Considering our ammunition supplies, I think we'd better find out," Monroe said. 2. The logical place to begin was the temple, with its enormous, menacing gorilla statue. They returned that afternoon and found behind the statue a succession of small, cubicle-like rooms. Ross thought that priests who worshipped the cult of the gorilla lived here. She had an elaborate explanation. The gorillas in the surrounding jungle terrorized the people of Zinj, who offered sacrifices to appease the gorillas. The priests were a separate class, secluded from society. "Look here, at the entrance to the line of cubicles, there is this little room. A guard stayed here to keep people away from the priests. It was a whole system of belief." Elliot was not convinced, and neither was Monroe. "Even religion is practical," Monroe said. "It's supposed to benefit you." "People worship what they fear," Ross said, hoping to control it. "But how could they control the gorillas?" Monroe asked. "What could they do?" When the answer finally came, it was startling, for they had it all backward. They moved past the cubicles to a series of long corridors decorated with bas-reliefs. Using their infrared computer system, they were able to see the reliefs, which were scenes arranged in a careful order, like a picture textbook. The first scene showed a series of caged gorillas. A black man stood near the cages, holding a stick in his hand. The second picture showed an African standing with two gorillas, holding ropes around their necks. A third showed an African instructing the gorillas in a courtyard. The gorillas were tethered to vertical poles, each with a ring at the top. The final picture showed the gorillas attacking a line of straw dummies, which hung from an overhead stone support. They now knew the meaning of what they had found in the courtyard of the gymnasium and the jail. "My God," Elliot said. "They trained them." Monroe nodded. "Trained them as guards to watch over the mines, an animal elite, ruthless and incorruptible. Not a bad idea when you think about it." Ross looked at the building around her again, realizing it wasn't a temple, but a school. An objection occurred to her. These pictures were hundreds of years old, the trainers long gone, yet the gorillas were still here. Who teaches them now? "They do," Elliot said. "They teach each other." "Is that possible?" "Perfectly possible. Conspecific teaching occurs among primates." This had been a long-standing question among researchers, but Washoe, the first primate in history to learn sign language, taught ASL to her offspring. Language-skilled primates freely taught other animals in captivity. For that matter, they would teach people, signing slowly and repeatedly, until the stupid, uneducated human person got the point. So it was possible for a primate tradition of language and behavior to be carried on for generations. "You mean," Ross said, "that the people in this city have been gone for centuries, but the gorillas they trained are still here?" "That's the way it looks," Elliot said. "And they use stone tools?" she asked. "Stone paddles?" "Yes," Elliot said. The idea of tool use was not as far-fetched as it first seemed. Chimpanzees were capable of elaborate tool use, of which the most striking example was termite fishing. Chimps would make a twig, carefully bending it to their specifications, and then spend hours over a termite mound, fishing with the stick to catch succulent grubs. Human observers labeled this activity primitive tool use until they tried it themselves. It turned out that making a satisfactory twig and catching termites was not primitive at all. At least it proved to be beyond the ability of people who tried to duplicate it. Human fishermen quit with a new respect for the chimpanzees and a new observation. They now noticed that younger chimps spent days watching their elders make sticks and twirl them in the mound. Young chimps literally learned how to do it, and the learning process extended over a period of years. This began to look suspiciously like culture. The apprenticeship of young Ben Franklin, printer, was not so different from the apprenticeship of young chimpanzee, termite fisher. Both learned their skills over a period of years by observing their elders. Both made mistakes on the way to ultimate success. Yet, manufactured stone tools implied a quantum jump beyond twigs and termites. The privileged position of stone tools as the special province of mankind might have remained sacrosanct were it not for a single iconoclastic researcher. In 1971, the British scientist R.V.S. Wright decided to teach an ape to make stone tools. His pupil was a 5-year-old orangutan named Abang in the Bristol Zoo. Wright presented Abang with a box containing food bound with a rope. He showed Abang how to cut the rope with the flint chip to get the food. Abang got the point in an hour. Wright then showed Abang how to make a stone chip by striking a pebble against a flint core. This was a more difficult lesson. Over a period of weeks, Abang required a total of 3 hours to learn to grasp the flint core between his toes, strike a sharp chip, cut the rope, and get the food. The point of the experiment was not that apes used stone tools, but that the ability to make stone tools was literally within their grasp. Wright's experiment was one more reason to think that human beings were not as unique as they had previously imagined themselves to be. But why would Amy say they weren't gorillas? Because they're not, Elliot said. These animals don't look like gorillas and they don't act like gorillas. They are physically and behaviorally different. He went on to voice his suspicion that not only had these animals been trained, they had been bred, perhaps interbred with chimpanzees, or, more strangely still, with men. They thought he was joking, but the facts were disturbing. In 1960, the first blood protein studies quantified the kinship between man and ape. Biochemically, man's nearest relative was the chimpanzee, much closer than the gorilla. In 1964, chimpanzee kidneys were successfully transplanted into men. Blood transfusions were also possible. But the degree of similarity was not fully known until 1975, when biochemists compared the DNA of chimps and men. It was discovered that chimps differed from men by only 1% of their DNA strands, and almost no one wanted to acknowledge one consequence. With modern DNA hybridization techniques and embryonic implantation, ape-ape crosses were certain, and man-ape crosses were possible. Of course, the 14th century inhabitants of Zinj had no way to mate DNA strands, but Elliot pointed out that they had consistently underestimated the skills of the Zinj people, who at the very least had managed 500 years ago to carry out sophisticated animal training procedures only duplicated by Western scientists within the last 10 years. And as Elliot saw it, the animals the Zinjians had trained presented an awesome problem. "We have to face the realities," she said. "When Amy was given a human IQ test, she scored 92. For all practical purposes, Amy is as smart as a human being, and in many ways she is smarter, more perceptive and sensitive. She can manipulate us at least as skillfully as we can manipulate her. These gray gorillas possess that same intelligence, yet they have been single-mindedly bred to be the primate equivalent of Doberman pinschers, guard animals, attack animals, trained for cunning and viciousness. But they are much brighter and more resourceful than dogs, and they will continue their attacks until they succeed in killing us all.
as they have killed everyone who has come here before. 3. Looking through the bars. In 1975, the mathematician S. L. Berensky reviewed the literature on primate language and reached a startling conclusion. "There is no doubt," he announced, "that primates are far superior in intelligence to man." In Berensky's mind, the salient question which every human visitor to the zoo intuitively asks is, who is behind the bars? Who is caged and who is free? On both sides of the bars, primates can be observed making faces at each other. It is too facile to say that man is superior because he has made the zoo. We impose our special horror of barred captivity, a form of punishment among our species, and assume that other primates feel as we do. Berensky likened primates to foreign ambassadors. Apes have for centuries managed to get along with human beings as ambassadors from their species. In recent years, they have even learned to communicate with human beings using sign language. But it is a one-sided diplomatic exchange. No human being has attempted to live in ape society, to master their language and customs, to eat their food, to live as they do. The apes have learned to talk to us, but we have never learned to talk to them. Who, then, should be judged the greater intellect? Berensky added a prediction. "The time will come," he said, "when circumstances may force some human beings to communicate with a primate society on its own terms. Only then human beings will become aware of their complacent egotism with regard to other animals." The Ertz expedition, isolated deep in the Congo rainforest, now faced just such a problem. Confronted by a new species of gorilla-like animal, they somehow had to deal with it on its own terms. During the evening, Elliot transmitted the taped breath sounds to Houston, and from there they were relayed to San Francisco. The transcript which followed the transmission was brief. Siemens wrote, "Received transmission. Should help. Important. Need translation soon," Elliot typed back. "When have?" "Computer analysis difficult. Problems exceed magnitude CSL/JSL translation." "What does that mean?" Ross said. "He's saying that the translation problems exceed the problem of translating Chinese or Japanese sign language." She hadn't known there was a Chinese or Japanese sign language, but Elliot explained that there were sign languages for all major languages, and each followed its own rules. For instance, BSL, British Sign Language, was totally different from ASL, American Sign Language, even though spoken and written English language was virtually identical in the two countries. Different sign languages had different grammar and syntax, and even obeyed different sign traditions. Chinese Sign Language used the middle finger pointing outward for several signs, such as 2 weeks from now and brother. Although this configuration was insulting and unacceptable in American Sign Language. "But this is a spoken language," Ross said. "Yes," Elliot said, "but it's a complicated problem. We aren't likely to get it translated soon." By nightfall, they had two additional pieces of information. Ross ran a computer simulation through Houston, which came back with a probability course of 3 days and a standard deviation of 2 days to find the diamond mines. That meant they should be prepared for 5 more days at the site. Food was not a problem, but ammunition was. Monroe proposed to use tear gas. They expected the gray guerrillas to try a different approach, and they did, attacking immediately after dark. The battle on the night of June 23rd was punctuated by the coughing explosions of canisters and the sizzling hiss of the gas. The strategy was effective. The guerrillas were driven away and did not return again that night. Monroe was pleased. He announced that they had enough tear gas to hold off the guerrillas for a week, perhaps more. For the moment, their problems appeared to be solved. Day 12. Zinj. June 24, 1979. 1. The Offensive. Shortly after dawn, they discovered the bodies of Mulewe and Akari near their tent. Apparently the attack the night before had been a diversion, allowing one guerrilla to enter the compound, kill the porters, and slip out again. Even more disturbing, they could find no clue to how the guerrilla had got through the electrified fence and back out again. A careful search revealed a section of fence torn near the bottom. A long stick lay on the ground nearby. The guerrillas had used the stick to lift the bottom of the fence, enabling one to crawl through. And before leaving, the guerrillas had carefully restored the fence to its original condition. The intelligence implied by such behavior was hard to accept. "Time and again," Elliot said later, "we came up against our prejudices about animals. We kept expecting the guerrillas to behave in stupid, stereotyped ways, but they never did. We never treated them as flexible and responsive adversaries, though they had already reduced our numbers by 1/4. Monroe had difficulty accepting the calculated hostility of the guerrillas. His experience had taught him that animals in nature were indifferent to man. Finally, he concluded that these animals had been trained by men, and I had to think of them as men. The question became, what would I do if they were men? For Monroe, the answer was clear. Take the offensive. Amy agreed to lead them into the jungle where she said the guerrillas lived. By 10 o'clock that morning, they were moving up the hillsides north of the city, armed with machine guns. It was not long before they found guerrilla spoor, quantities of dung, and nests on the ground and in the trees. Monroe was disturbed by what he saw. Some trees held 20 or 30 nests, suggesting a large population of animals. 10 minutes later, they came upon a group of 10 gray guerrillas feeding on succulent vines. 4 males and 3 females, a juvenile, and 2 scampering infants. The adults were lazy, basking in the sun, eating in desultory fashion. Several other animals slept on their backs, snoring loudly. They all seemed remarkably unguarded. Monroe gave a hand signal. The safeties clicked off the guns. He prepared to fire into the group when Amy tugged at his trouser leg. He looked off and had the shock of my bloody life. Up the slope was another group, perhaps 10 or 12 animals. And then I saw another group, and another still. There must have been 300 or more. The hillside was crawling with gray gorillas. The largest gorilla group ever sighted in the wild had been 31 individuals in Kabara in 1971. And even that sighting was disputed. Most researchers thought it was actually 2 groups seen briefly together, since the usual group size was 10 to 15 individuals. Elliot found 300 animals, an awesome sight. But he was even more impressed by the behavior of the animals. As they browsed and fed in the sunlight, they behaved very much like ordinary gorillas in the wild, but there were important differences. From the first sighting, I never had any doubt that they had language. Their wheezing vocalizations were striking and clearly constituted a form of language. In addition, they used sign language, although nothing like what we knew. Their hand gestures were delivered with outstretched arms in a graceful way, rather like Thai dancers. These hand movements seemed to complement or add to the sighing vocalizations. Obviously, the gorillas had been taught or had elaborated on their own a language system far more sophisticated than the pure sign language of laboratory apes in the 20th century. Some abstract corner of Elliot's mind considered this discovery tremendously exciting, but at the same time, he shared the fear of the others around him. Crouched behind the dense foliage, they held their breath and watched the gorillas feed on the opposite hillside. Although the gorillas seemed peaceful, the humans watching them felt a tension approaching panic at being so close to such great numbers of them. Finally, at Monroe's signal, they slipped back down the trail and returned to the camp. The porters were digging graves for Akari and Mulewe in camp. It was a grim reminder of their jeopardy as they discussed their alternatives. Monroe said to Elliot, "They don't seem to be aggressive during the day." "No," Elliot said. "Their behavior looks quite typical. If anything, it's more sluggish than that of ordinary gorillas in daytime. Probably most of the males are sleeping during the day." "How many animals on the hillside are males?" Monroe asked. They had already concluded that only male animals participated in the attacks. Monroe was asking for odds. Elliot said, "Most studies have found that adult males constitute 15% of gorilla groupings, and most studies show that isolated observations underestimate troop size by 25%. There are more animals than you see at any given moment. The arithmetic was disheartening. They had counted 300 gorillas on the hillside, which meant there were probably 400, of which 15% were males. That meant that there were 60 attacking animals, and only 9 in their defending group. "Hard," Monroe said, shaking his head. Amy had one solution. She signed, "Go now." Ross asked what she said, and Elliot told her, "She wants to leave. I think she's right." "Don't be ridiculous," Ross said. "We haven't found the diamonds. We can't leave now." "Go now," Amy signed again. They looked at Monroe. Somehow the group had decided that Monroe would make the decision of what to do next. "I want the diamonds as much as anyone," he said. "But they won't be much use to us if we're dead. We have no choice. We must leave if we can." Ross swore in florid Texan style. Elliot said to Monroe, "What do you mean, if we can?" "I mean," Monroe said, "that they may not let us leave." 2. Departure. Following Monroe's instructions, they carried only minimal supplies of food and ammunition. They left everything else, the tents, the perimeter defenses, the communications equipment, everything in the sunlit clearing at midday. Monroe glanced back over his shoulder and hoped he was doing the right thing. In the 1960s, the Congo mercenaries had had an ironic rule, "Don't leave home." It had multiple meanings, including the obvious one that none of them should ever have come to the Congo in the first place. It also meant that once established in a fortified camp or colonial town, you were unwise to step out into the surrounding jungle, whatever the provocation. Several of Monroe's friends had bought it in the jungle because they had foolishly left home. The news would come to them. "Digger bought it last week outside Stanleyville." Outside? Why'd he leave home? Monroe was leading the expedition outside now, and home was the little silver camp with its perimeter defense behind them. Back in that camp, they were sitting ducks for the attacking gorillas. The mercenaries had had something to say about that, too. Better a sitting duck than a dead duck. As they marched through the rainforest, Monroe was painfully aware of the single-file column strung out behind him, the least defensible formation. He watched the jungle foliage move in as their path narrowed. He did not remember this track being so narrow when they had come to the city. Now they were hemmed in by close ferns and spreading palms. The gorillas might be only a few feet away, concealed in the dense foliage, and they wouldn't know it until it was too late. They walked on. Monroe thought if they could reach the eastern slopes of Mukenko, they would be all right. The gray gorillas were localized near the city and would not follow them far. 1 or 2 hours walking, and they would be beyond danger. He checked his watch. They had been gone 10 minutes. And then he heard the sighing sound. It seemed to come from all directions. He saw the foliage moving before him, shifting as if blown by a wind. Only there was no wind. He heard the sighing grow louder. The column halted at the edge of a ravine which followed a stream bed past sloping jungle walls on both sides. It was the perfect spot for an ambush. Along the line, he heard the safeties click on the machine guns. Kahega came up. "Captain, what do we do?" Monroe watched the foliage move and heard the sighing. He could only guess at the numbers concealed in the bush. 20? 30? Too many in any case. Kahega pointed up the hillside to a track that ran above the ravine. "Go up there?" For a long time, Monroe did not answer. Finally, he said, "No, not up there."
"Then where, Captain?"
"Back," Monroe said. "We go back." When they turned away from the ravine, the sighing faded, and the foliage ceased its movement. When he looked back over his shoulder for a last glimpse, the ravine appeared an ordinary passage in the jungle without threat of any kind. But Monroe knew the truth. They could not leave. 3. Return. Elliot's idea came in a flash of insight. In the middle of the camp, he later related, I was looking at Amy signing to Cahiga. Amy was asking him for a drink, but Cahiga didn't know Amazlan, and he kept shrugging helplessly. It occurred to me that the linguistic skill of the gray gorillas was both their great advantage and their Achilles heel. Elliot proposed to capture a single gray gorilla, learn its language, and use that language to establish communication with the other animals. Under normal circumstances, it would take several months to learn a new ape language, but Elliot thought he could do it in a matter of hours. Siemens was already at work on the gray gorilla verbalizations. All he needed was further input. But Elliot had decided that the gray gorillas employed a combination of spoken sounds and sign language, and the sign language would be easy to work out. Back at Berkeley, Siemens had developed a computer program called APE for Animal Pattern Explanation. APE was capable of observing Amy and assigning meanings to her signs. Since the APE program utilized declassified Army software subroutines for code breaking, it was capable of identifying new signs and translating these as well. Although APE was intended to work with Amy in ASL, there was no reason why it would not work with an entirely new language. If they could forge satellite links from the Congo to Houston to Berkeley, they could feed video data from a captive animal directly into the APE program. An APE promised a speed of translation far beyond the capacity of any human observer. The Army software was designed to break enemy codes in minutes. Elliot and Ross were convinced it would work. Monroe was not. He made some disparaging comments about interrogating prisoners of war. "What do you intend to do?" he said. "Torture the animal?" "We will employ situational stress," Elliot said, "to elicit language usage." He was laying out test materials on the ground. A banana, a bowl of water, a piece of candy, a stick, a succulent vine, stone paddles. "We'll scare the hell out of her if we have to." "Her?" "Of course," Elliot said, loading the Thorolan dart gun. "Her." 4. Capture. He wanted a female without an infant. An infant would create difficulties. Pushing through waist-high undergrowth, he found himself on the edge of a sharp ridge and saw 9 animals grouped below him. 2 males, 5 females, and 2 juveniles. They were foraging through the jungle 20 feet below. He watched the group long enough to be sure that all the females used language and that there were no infants concealed in the foliage. Then he waited for his chance. The gorillas fed casually among the ferns, plucking up tender shoots, which they chewed lazily. After several minutes, one female moved up from the group to forage nearer the top of the ridge where he was crouching. She was separated from the rest of the group by more than 10 yards. Elliot raised the dart pistol in both hands and squinted on the sight at the female. She was perfectly positioned. He watched, squeezed the trigger slowly, and lost his footing on the ridge. He fell crashing down the slope right into the midst of the gorillas. Elliot lay unconscious on his back, 20 feet below. But his chest was moving and his arm twitched. Monroe felt certain that he was all right. Monroe was only concerned about the gorillas. The gray gorillas had seen Elliot fall and now moved toward the body. 8 or 9 animals clustered around him, staring impassively, signing. Monroe slipped the safety off his gun. Elliot groaned, touched his head, and opened his eyes. Monroe saw Elliot stiffen as he saw the gorillas, but he did not move. 3 mature males crouched very close to him, and he understood the precariousness of his situation. Elliot lay motionless on the ground for nearly a minute. The gorillas whispered and signed, but they did not come any closer. Finally, Elliot sat up on one elbow, which caused a burst of signing, but no direct threatening behavior. On the hillside above, Amy tugged at Monroe's sleeve, signing emphatically. Monroe shook his head. He did not understand. He raised his machine gun again, and Amy bit his kneecap. The pain was excruciating. It was all Monroe could do to keep from screaming. Elliot, lying on the ground below, tried to control his breathing. The gorillas were very close enough for him to touch them, close enough to smell the sweet, musty odor of their bodies. They were agitated. The males had started grunting, a rhythmic ho-ho-ho. He decided he had better get to his feet slowly and methodically. He thought that if he could put some distance between himself and the animals, their sense of threat would be reduced. But as soon as he began to move, the grunting grew louder, and one of the males began a sideways, crab-like movement, slapping the ground with his flat palms. Immediately, Elliot lay back down. The gorillas relaxed, and he decided he had done the correct thing. The animals were confused by this human being crashing down in their midst. They apparently did not expect contact with men in foraging areas. He decided to wait them out, if necessary, remaining on his back for several hours until they lost interest and moved off. He breathed slowly, regularly, aware that he was sweating. Probably he smelled of fear. But like men, gorillas had a poorly developed sense of smell. They did not react to the odor of fear. He waited. The gorillas were sighing and signing swiftly, trying to decide what to do. Then one male abruptly resumed his crabwise movements, slapping the ground and staring at Elliot. Elliot did not move. In his mind, he reviewed the stages of attack behavior, grunting, sideways movement, slapping, tearing up grass, beating chest, charging. The male gorilla began tearing up grass. Elliot felt his heart pounding. The gorilla was a huge animal, easily 300 pounds. He reared up on his hind legs and beat his chest with flat palms, making a hollow sound. Elliot wondered what Monroe was doing above. And then he heard a crash, and he looked up to see Amy tumbling down the hillside, breaking her fall by grabbing at branches and ferns. She landed at Elliot's feet. The gorillas could not have been more surprised. The large male ceased beating his chest, dropped down from his upright posture, and glowered at Amy. Amy grunted. The large male moved menacingly toward Peter, but he never took his eyes off Amy. Amy watched him without response. It was a clear test of dominance. The male moved closer and closer, without hesitation. Amy bellowed, a deafening sound. Elliot jumped in surprise. He had only heard her do it once or twice before, in moments of extreme rage. It was unusual for females to roar, and the other gorillas were alarmed. Amy's forearms stiffened. Her back went rigid. Her face became tense. She stared aggressively at the male and roared again. The male paused, tilted his head to one side. He seemed to be thinking it over. Finally, he backed off, rejoining the semicircle of gray apes around Elliot's head. Amy deliberately rested her hand on Elliot's leg, establishing possession. A juvenile male, 4 or 5 years old, impulsively scurried forward, baring his teeth. Amy slapped him across the face, and the juvenile whined and scrambled back to the safety of his group. Amy glowered at the other gorillas, and then she began signing, "Go away, leave, Amy, go away." The gorillas did not respond. Peter, good human person. But she seemed to be aware that the gorillas did not understand, for she then did something remarkable. She sighed, making the same wheezing sound that the gorillas made. The gorillas were startled and stared at one another. But if Amy was speaking their language, it was without effect. They remained where they were. And the more she sighed, the more their reaction diminished until finally they stared blandly at her. She was not getting through to them. Amy now came alongside Peter's head and began to groom him, plucking at his beard and scalp. The gray gorillas signed rapidly. Then the male began his rhythmic ho-ho-ho once more. When she saw this, Amy turned to Peter and signed, "Amy, hug Peter." He was surprised. Amy never volunteered to hug Peter. Ordinarily, she only wanted Peter to hug and tickle Amy. Elliot sat up, and she immediately pulled him to her chest, pressing his face into her hair. At once, the male gorilla ceased grunting. The gray gorillas began to backpedal, as if they had committed some error. In that moment, Elliot understood. She was treating him like her infant. This was classic primate behavior in aggressive situations. Primates carried strong inhibitions against harming infants, and this inhibition was invoked by adult animals in many contexts. Male baboons often ended their fight when one male grabbed an infant and clutched it to his chest. The sight of the small animal inhibited further attack. Chimpanzees showed more subtle variations of the same thing. If juvenile chimp play turned too brutal, A male would grab one juvenile and clutch it maternally, even though in this case both parent and child were symbolic. Yet the posture was sufficient to evoke the inhibition against further violence. In this case, Amy was not only halting the male's attack, but protecting Elliot as well by treating him as an infant, if the gorillas would accept a bearded, 6-foot-tall infant. They did. They disappeared back into the foliage. Amy released Elliot from her fierce grip. She looked at him and signed, "Dumb things." "Thank you, Amy," he said and kissed her. "Peter, tickle Amy. Amy, good gorilla." "You bet," he said, and he tickled her for the next several minutes while she rolled on the ground, grunting happily. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon when they returned to camp. Ross said, "Did you get a gorilla?" "No," Elliot said. "Well, it doesn't matter," Ross said, "because I can't raise Houston." Elliot was stunned. More electronic jamming? "Worse than that," Ross said. She had spent an hour trying to establish a satellite link with Houston, and had failed. Each time, the link was broken within seconds. Finally, after confirming that there was no fault with her equipment, she had checked the date. "It's June 24th, she said, "and we had communications trouble with the last Congo expedition on May 28th. That's 27 days ago. When Elliot still didn't get it, Monroe said, "She's telling you it's solar." "That's right," Ross said. "This is an ionospheric disturbance of solar origin. Most disruptions of the Earth's ionosphere, the thin layer of ionized molecules 50 to 250 miles up, were caused by phenomena such as sunspots on the surface of the sun. Since the sun rotated every 27 days, these disturbances often recurred a month later." "Okay," Elliot said. "It's solar. How long will it last?" Ross shook her head. "Ordinarily, I would say a few hours, a day at most, but this seems to be a severe disturbance, and it's come up very suddenly. 5 hours ago, we had perfect communications, and now we have none at all. Something unusual is going on. It could last a week." "No communications for a week? No computer tie-ins? No nothing?" "That's right," Ross said evenly. "From this moment on, we are entirely cut off from the outside world." 5. Isolation. The largest solar flare of 1979 was recorded on June 24th by the Kitt Peak Observatory near Tucson, Arizona, and duly passed on to the Space Environment Services Center in Boulder, Colorado. At first, the SESC did not believe the incoming data. Even by the gigantic standards of solar astronomy, this flare, designated 78/06/414AA, was a monster. The cause of solar flares is unknown, but they are generally associated with sunspots. In this case, the flare appeared as an extremely bright spot 10,000 miles in diameter, affecting not only alpha hydrogen and ionized calcium spectral lines, but also the white light spectrum from the sun. Such a continuous spectrum flare was extremely rare. Nor could the SESC believe the computed consequences. Solar flares release an enormous amount of energy. Even a modest flare can double the amount of ultraviolet radiation emitted by the entire solar surface. But flare 78/06/414AA was almost tripling ultraviolet emissions. Within 8.3 minutes of its first appearance along the rotating rim, the time it takes light to reach the Earth from the sun, this surge of ultraviolet radiation began to disrupt the ionosphere of the Earth. The consequence of the flare was that radio communications on a planet 93 million miles away were seriously disrupted. This was especially true for radio transmissions, which utilized low signal strengths. Commercial radio stations generating kilowatts of power were hardly inconvenienced, but the Congo Field Survey, transmitting signals on the order of 20,000 watts, was unable to establish satellite links. And since the solar flare also ejected X-rays and atomic particles, which would not reach the Earth for a full day, the radio disruption would last at least one day, and perhaps longer. At ERTS in Houston, technicians reported to Travis that the SESC predicted a time course of ionic destruction of 4 to 8 days. "You mean we're going to be out of contact with them for 4 to 8 days?" Travis said. "That's how it looks. Ross'll probably figure it out, the technician said, when she can't reestablish today. They need that computer hookup, Travis said. The ERTS staff had run 5 computer simulations, and the outcome was always the same. Short of airlifting in a small army, Ross's expedition was in serious trouble. Survival projections were running 0.244 and change. Only 1 chance in 4 that the Congo expedition would get out alive, assuming the help of the computer link, which was now broken. Travis wondered if Ross and the others realized how grave their situation was. Any new Band 5 on Mukenko? Travis asked. Band 5 on Landsat satellites recorded infrared data. On its last pass over the Congo, Landsat had acquired significant new information on Mukenko. The volcano had become much hotter in the 9 days since the previous Landsat pass. The temperature increase was on the order of 8 degrees. Nothing new, the technician said, and the computers don't project an eruption. 4 degrees of orbital change are within sensor error on that system, and the additional 4 degrees have no predictive value. Well, that's something, Travis said. But what are they going to do about the apes now that they're cut off from the computer? That was the question the Congo Field Survey had been asking themselves for the better part of an hour. With communications disrupted, the only computers available were the computers in their own heads, and those computers were not powerful enough. Elliot found it strange to think that his own brain was inadequate. We had all become accustomed to the availability of computing power, he said later. In any decent laboratory, you can get all the memory and all the computation speed you could want, day or night. We were so used to it, we had come to take it for granted. Of course, they could have eventually worked out the ape language, but they were up against a time factor. They didn't have months to puzzle it out. They had hours. Cut off from the ape program. Their situation was ominous. Monroe said that they could not survive another night of frontal attack, and they had every reason to expect an attack that night. Amy's rescue of Elliot suggested their plan. Amy had shown some ability to communicate with the guerrillas. Perhaps she could translate for them as well. It's worth a try, Elliot insisted. Unfortunately, Amy herself denied that this was possible. In response to the question, Amy talk thing talk, she signed, no talk. Not at all, Elliot said, remembering the way she had sighed. Peter see Amy talk thing talk. No talk, make noise. He concluded from this that she was able to mimic the gorilla verbalizations, but had no knowledge of their meaning. It was now past 2. They had only 4 or 5 hours until nightfall. Monroe said, "Give it up. She obviously can't help us." Monroe preferred to break camp and fight their way out in daylight. He was convinced that they could not survive another night among the gorillas. But something nagged at Elliot's mind. After years of working with Amy, he knew she had the maddening, literal-mindedness of a child. With Amy, especially when she was feeling uncooperative, it was necessary to be exact to elicit the appropriate response. Now he looked at Amy and said, "Amy talk thing talk?" "No talk." "Amy understand thing talk?" Amy did not answer. She was chewing on vines, preoccupied. "Amy, listen to Peter." She stared at him. "Amy, understand thing talk?" "Amy, understand thing talk," she signed back. She did it so matter-of-factly that at first he wondered if she realized what he was asking her. "Amy, watch thing talk. Amy, understand talk?" "Amy, understand." "Amy, sure?" "Amy, sure." "I'll be goddamned," Elliot said. Monroe was shaking his head. "We've only got a few hours of daylight left," he said. "And even if you do learn their language, how are you going to talk to them?" 6. Amy talk thing talk. At 3 p.m., Elliot and Amy were completely concealed in the foliage along the hillside. The only sign of their presence was the slender cone of the microphone that protruded through the foliage. The microphone was connected to the videotape recorder at Elliot's feet, which he used to record the sounds of the gorillas on the hills beyond.
The only difficulty was trying to determine which gorilla the directional microphone had focused on, and which gorilla Amy had focused on, and whether they were the same gorilla. He could never be quite sure that Amy was translating the verbal utterances of the same animal that he was recording. There were 8 gorillas in the nearest group, and Amy kept getting distracted. One female had a 6-month-old infant, and at one point, when the baby was bitten by a bee, Amy signed, "Baby Mad." But Elliot was recording a male. "Amy," he signed, "pay attention. Amy, pay attention. Amy, good gorilla." "Yes," he signed, "Amy, good gorilla. Amy, pay attention, man thing. Amy, not like." He swore silently and erased 30 minutes of translations from Amy. She had obviously been paying attention to the wrong gorilla. When he started the tape again, he decided that this time he would record whatever Amy was watching. He signed, "What thing Amy watch?" "Amy watch baby." That wouldn't work because the baby didn't speak. He signed, "Amy watch woman thing." "Amy like watch baby." This dependency on Amy was like a bad dream. He was in the hands of an animal whose thinking and behavior he barely understood. He was cut off from the wider society of human beings and human machinery, thus increasing his dependency on the animal. And yet he had to trust her. After another hour, with the sunlight fading, he took Amy back down the hillside to the camp. Monroe had planned as best he could. First he dug a series of holes, like elephant traps, outside the camp. They were deep pits lined with sharp stakes covered with leaves and branches. He widened the moat in several places and cleared away dead trees and underbrush that might be used as bridges. He cut down the low tree branches overhanging the camp so that if gorillas went into the trees, they would be kept at least 30 feet above the ground, too high to jump down. He gave 3 of the remaining porters, Musesi, Amburi, and Harawi, shotguns along with a supply of tear gas canisters. With Ross, he boosted power on the perimeter fence to almost 200 amps. This was the maximum the thin mesh could handle without melting. They had been obliged to reduce the pulses from 4 to 2 per second. But the additional current changed the fence from a deterrent to a lethal barrier. The first animals to hit that fence would be immediately killed, although the likelihood of shorts and a dead fence was considerably increased. At sunset, Monroe made his most difficult decision. He loaded the stubby, tripod-mounted RFSDs with 1/2 of their remaining ammunition. When that was gone, the machines would simply stop firing. From that point on, Monroe was counting on Elliot and Amy and their translation. And Elliot did not look very happy when he came back down the hill. 7. Final defense. "How long until you're ready?" Monroe asked him. "A couple of hours, maybe more." Elliot asked Ross to help him, and Amy went to get food from Cahiga. She seemed very proud of herself and behaved like an important person in the group. Ross said, "Did it work?" "We'll know in a minute," Elliot said. His first plan was to run the only kind of internal check on Amy that he could by verifying repetitions of sounds. If she had consistently translated sounds in the same way, they would have a reason for confidence. But it was painstaking work. They had only the 1/2-inch VTR and the small pocket tape recorder. There were no connecting cables. They called for silence from the others in the camp and proceeded to run the checks, taping, retaping, listening to the whispering sounds. At once they found that their ears simply weren't capable of discriminating the sounds. Everything sounded the same. Then Ross had an idea. "These sounds taped," she said, "as electrical signals."
"Yes."
"Well, the link-up transmitter has a 256K memory."
"But we can't link up to the Houston computer."
"I don't mean that," Ross said. She explained that the satellite link-up was made by having the 256K computer on site match an internally generated signal, like a video test pattern, to a transmitted signal from Houston. That was how they locked on. The machine was built that way, but they could use the matching program for other purposes.
You mean we can use it to compare these sounds?
Elliot said. They could, but it was incredibly slow. They had to transfer the taped sounds to the computer memory and re-record it in the VTR on another portion of the tape bandwidth. Then they had to input that signal into the computer memory and run a second comparison tape on the VTR.
Elliot found that he was standing by, watching Ross shuffle tape cartridges and mini floppy disks. Every half hour, Monroe would wander over to ask how it was coming.
Ross became increasingly snappish and irritable. "We're going as fast as we can," she said. It was now 8 o'clock.
But the first results were encouraging. Amy was indeed consistent in her translations. By 9 o'clock, they had quantified matching on almost a dozen words. Food. 0.9213. 0.112. Eat. 0.8844. 0.334. Water. 0.9978. 0.004. Drink. 0.7743. 0.334. Affirmation. Yes. 0.6654. 0.441. Negation. No. 0.8883. 0.220. Come. 0.5459. 0.440. Go. 0.5378. 0.404.
Sound complex. ? Away. 0.5444. 0.343. Sound complex. ? Here. 0.6344. 0.344. Sound complex. ? Anger. ? Bad. 0.4232. 0.477.
Ross stepped away from the computer. All yours, she said to Elliot.
Monroe paced across the compound. This was the worst time. Everyone waiting, on edge, nerves shot. He would have joked with Cahega and the other porters, but Ross and Elliot needed silence for their work. He glanced at Cahega. Cahega pointed to the sky and rubbed his fingers together. Monroe nodded. He had felt it too, the heavy dampness in the air, the almost palpable feeling of electrical charge. Rain was coming. That was all they needed, he thought. During the afternoon, there had been more booming and distant explosions, which he had thought were far-off lightning storms. But the sound was not right. These were sharp, single reports, more like a sonic boom than anything else. Monroe had heard them before, and he had an idea about what they meant. He glanced up at the dark cone of Mukenko and the faint glow of the Devil's Eye. He looked at the crossed green laser beams overhead, and he noticed one of the beams was moving where it struck foliage in the trees above. At first he thought it was an illusion that the leaf was moving and not the beam. But after a moment he was sure the beam itself was quivering, shifting up and down in the night air. Monroe knew this was an ominous development, but it would have to wait until later. At the moment there were more pressing concerns. He looked across the compound at Elliot and Ross bent over their equipment, talking quietly, and in general behaving as if they had all the time in the world. Elliot actually was going as fast as he could. He had 11 reliable vocabulary words recorded on tape. His problem now was to compose an unequivocal message. This was not as easy as it first appeared. For one thing, the gorilla language was not a pure verbal language. The gorillas used sign and sound combinations to convey information. This raised a classic problem in language structure. How was the information actually conveyed? L. S. Virinsky once said that if alien visitors watched Italians speaking, they would conclude that Italian was basically a gestural sign language with sounds added for emphasis only. Elliot needed a simple message that did not depend on accompanying hand signs. But he had no idea of gorilla syntax, which could critically alter meaning in most circumstances. The difference between me beat and beat me. And even a short message could be ambiguous in another language. In English, look out generally meant the opposite of its literal meaning. Faced with these uncertainties, Elliot considered broadcasting a single word, but none of the words on his list was suitable. His second choice was to broadcast several short messages in case one was inadvertently ambiguous. He eventually decided on 3 messages. Go away. No come. And bad here. 2 of these combinations had the virtue of being essentially independent of word order.
By 9 o'clock, they had already isolated the specific sound components, but they still had a complicated task ahead. What Elliot needed was a loop repeating the sounds over and over. The closest they would come was the VCR, which rewound automatically to play its message again. He could hold the 6 sounds in the 256K memory and play them out, but the timing was critical. For the next hour, they frantically punched buttons, trying to bring the word combinations close enough together to sound, to their ears, correct. By then, it was after 10. Monroe came over with his laser gun. "You think all this will work?" Elliot shook his head. "There's no way to know." A dozen objections had come to mind. They had recorded the female voice, but would the gorillas respond to a female? Would they accept voice sounds without accompanying hand signals? Would the message be clear? Would the spacing of the sounds be acceptable? Would the gorillas pay attention at all? There was no way to know. They would simply have to try. Equally uncertain was the problem of broadcasting. Ross had made a speaker, removing the tiny speaker from the pocket tape recorder and gluing it to an umbrella on a collapsible tripod. This makeshift speaker produced surprisingly loud volume, but reproduction was muffled and unconvincing. Shortly afterward, they heard the first sighing sounds. Monroe swung the laser gun through the darkness, the red activation light glowing on the electronic pod at the end of the barrel. Through his night goggles, he surveyed the foliage. Once again, the sighing came from all directions, and although he heard the jungle foliage shifting, he saw no movement close to the camp. The monkeys overhead were silent. There was only the soft, ominous sighing. Listening now, Monroe was convinced that the sounds represented a language of some form, and a single gorilla appeared, and Kahega fired, his laser beam streaking arrow straight through the night. The RFSD chattered, and the foliage snapped with bullets. The gorilla ducked silently back into a stand of dense ferns. Monroe and the others quickly took positions along the perimeter, crouching tensely, the infrared nightlights casting their shadows on the mesh fence and the jungle beyond. The sighing continued for several minutes longer, and then slowly faded away, until all was silent again. "What was that about?" Ross said. Monroe frowned. "They're waiting." "For what?" Monroe shook his head. He circled the compound, looking at the other guards, trying to work it out. Many times he had anticipated the behavior of animals, a wounded leopard in the bush, a cornered buffalo. But this was different. He was forced to admit he didn't know what to expect. Had the single gorilla been a scout to look at their defenses? Or had an attack actually begun only for some reason to be halted? Was it a maneuver designed to fray nerves? Monroe had watched parties of hunting chimpanzees make brief threatening forays toward baboons to raise the anxiety level of the entire troop before the actual assault, isolating some young animal for killing. Then he heard the rumble of thunder. Kahega pointed to the sky, shaking his head. That was their answer. "Damn," Monroe said. At 10:30, a torrential tropical rain poured down on them. Their fragile speaker was immediately soaked and drooping. The rain shorted the electrical cables, and the perimeter fence went dead. The nightlights flickered, and 2 bulbs exploded. The ground turned to mud. Visibility was reduced to 5 yards. And worst of all, the rain splattering the foliage was so noisy, they had to shout to each other. The tapes were unfinished, the loudspeaker probably would not work, and certainly would not carry over the rain. The rain would interfere with the lasers and prevent the dispersal of tear gas. Faces in camp were grim. 5 minutes later, the gorillas attacked. The rain masked their approach. They seemed to burst out of nowhere, striking the fence from 3 directions simultaneously. From that first moment, Elliot realized the attack would be unlike the others. The gorillas had learned from the earlier assaults and now were intent on finishing the job. Primate attack animals, trained for cunning and viciousness. Even though that was Elliot's own assessment, he was astonished to see the proof in front of him. The gorillas charged in waves, like disciplined shock troops. Yet he found it more horrifying than an attack by human troops. "To them, we are just animals," he thought. "An alien species for which they have no feeling. We are just pests to be eliminated."
These guerrillas did not care why human beings were there or what reasons had brought them to the Congo. They were not killing for food or defense or protection of their young. They were killing because they were trained to kill. The attack proceeded with stunning swiftness. Within seconds, the guerrillas had breached the perimeter and trampled the mesh fence into the mud. Unchecked, they rushed into the compound, grunting and roaring. The driving rain matted their hair, giving them a sleek, menacing appearance in the red nightlights. Elliot saw 10 or 15 animals inside the compound, trampling the tents and attacking the people. Azizi was killed immediately, his skull crushed between paddles. Monroe, Kahega, and Ross all fired laser bursts, but in the confusion and poor visibility, their effectiveness was limited. The laser beams fragmented in the slashing rain. The tracer bullets hissed and sputtered. One of the RFSDs went haywire, the barrel swinging in wide arcs, bullets spitting out in all directions, while everyone dived into the mud. Several guerrillas were killed by the RFSD bursts, clutching their chests in a bizarre mimicry of human death. Elliot turned back to the recording equipment, and Amy flung herself on him, panicked, grunting in fear. He pushed her away and switched on the tape replay. By now, the guerrillas had overwhelmed everyone in the camp. Monroe lay on his back, a guerrilla on top of him. Ross was nowhere to be seen. Kahega had a guerrilla clinging to his chest as he rolled in the mud. Elliot was hardly aware of the hideous scratching sounds now emanating from the loudspeaker, and the guerrillas themselves paid no attention. Another porter, Muzazi, screamed as he stepped in front of a firing RFSD. His frame shook with the impact of the bullets, and he fell backward to the ground, his body smoking from the tracers. At least a dozen guerrillas were dead or lying wounded in the mud, groaning. The haywire RFSD had run out of ammunition. The barrel swung back and forth, the empty chamber clicking. A guerrilla kicked it over, and it lay writhing on its side in the mud like a living thing as the barrel continued to swing. Elliot saw one guerrilla crouched over, methodically tearing a tent apart, shredding the silver mylar into strips. Across the camp, another arrival banged aluminum cook pans together as if they were metal paddles. More guerrillas poured into the compound, ignoring the rasping, broadcast sounds. He saw a guerrilla pass beneath the loudspeaker very close and pay no attention at all. Elliot had the sickening realization that their plan had failed. They were finished. It was only a matter of time. A guerrilla charged him, bellowing in rage, swinging stone paddles wide. Terrified, Amy threw her hands over Elliot's eyes. "Amy!" he shouted, pulling her fingers away, expecting to feel at any moment the impact of the paddles and the instant of blinding pain. He saw the gorilla bearing down on him. He tensed his body. 6 feet away, the charging gorilla stopped so abruptly that he literally skidded in the mud and fell backward. He sat there surprised, cocking his head, listening. Then Elliot realized that the rain had nearly stopped, that there was now only a light drizzle sifting down over the campsite. Looking across the compound, Elliot saw another gorilla stop to listen, then another, and another, and another. The compound took on the quality of a frozen tableau as the gorillas stood silent in the mist. They were listening to the broadcast sounds. He held his breath, not daring to hope. The gorillas seemed uncertain, confused by the sounds they heard. Yet Elliot sensed that at any moment they could arrive at some group decision and resume their attack with the same intensity as before. That did not happen. The guerrillas stepped away from the people, listening. Monroe scrambled to his feet, raising his gun from the mud, but he did not shoot. The guerrilla standing over him seemed to be in a trance, to have forgotten all about the attack. In the gentle rain, with the flickering night lights, the guerrillas moved away, one by one. They seemed perplexed, off balance. The rasping continued over the loudspeaker. The guerrillas left, moving back across the trampled perimeter fence, disappearing once more into the jungle. And then the expedition members were alone, staring at each other, shivering in the misty rain. The guerrillas were gone. 20 minutes later, as they were trying to rebuild their shattered campsite, the rain poured down again with unabated fury. Day 13, Mukenko, June 25th,
1979. 1. Diamonds. In the morning, a fine layer of black ash covered the campsite, and in the distance, Mukenko was belching great quantities of black smoke. Amy tugged at Elliot's sleeve. "Leave now," she signed insistently. "No, Amy," he said. Nobody in the expedition was in a mood to leave, including Elliot. Upon arising, he found himself thinking of additional data he needed before leaving Zinj. Elliot was no longer satisfied with the skeleton of one of these creatures. Like men, their uniqueness went beyond the details of physical structure to their behavior. Elliot wanted videotapes of the gray apes and more recordings of verbalizations. And Ross was more determined than ever to find the diamonds, with Monroe no less interested. "Leave now." "Why leave now?" he asked her. "Earth bad, leave now." Elliot had no experience with volcanic activity, but what he saw did not impress him. Mukenko was more active than it had been in previous days, but the volcano had ejected smoke and gas since their first arrival in Virunga. He asked Monroe, "Is there any danger?" Monroe shrugged.
"Cahiga thinks so, but he probably just wants an excuse to go home."
Amy came running over to Monroe, raising her arms, slapping them down on the earth in front of him. Monroe recognized this as her desire to play. He laughed and began to tickle Amy. She signed to him. "What's she saying?" Monroe asked. "What are you saying, you little devil?" Amy grunted with pleasure and continued to sign.
"She says leave now," Elliot translated.
Monroe stopped tickling her.
"Does she?"
he asked sharply.
"What exactly does she say?"
Elliot was surprised at Monroe's seriousness, although Amy accepted his interest in her communication as perfectly proper. She signed again, more slowly, for Monroe's benefit, her eyes on his face.
"She says the earth is bad."
"Hmm," Monroe said. "Interesting." He glanced at Amy, and then at his watch. Amy signed, "Nose hair man, listen, Amy, go home now."
"She says you listen to her and go home now," Elliot said.
Monroe shrugged.
"Tell her I understand,"
Elliot translated. Amy looked unhappy and did not sign again.
"Where's Ross?"
Monroe asked.
"Here,"
Ross said.
"Let's get moving,"
Monroe said, and they headed for the lost city. Now they had another surprise. Amy signed she was coming with them, and she hurried to catch up with them. This was their final day in the city, and all the participants in the Congo expedition described a similar reaction. The city, which had been so mysterious before, was somehow stripped of its mystery. On this morning, they saw the city for what it was, a cluster of crumbling old buildings in a hot, stinking, uncomfortable jungle. They all found it tedious, except for Monroe. Monroe was worried. Elliot was bored, talking about verbalizations and why he wanted tape recordings and whether it was possible to preserve a brain from one of the apes to take back with them. It seemed there was some academic debate about where language came from. People used to think language was a development of animal cries, but now they knew that animal barks and cries were controlled by the limbic system of the brain, and that real language came from some other part of the brain called Broca's area. Monroe couldn't pay attention. He kept listening to the distant rumbling of Mukenko. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.